Okay, good morning, everybody. This is about 2:41, and it is October 16th. And this is our last lecture on nervous system, which means that it's the last lecture before exam two. So this information will be on exam two. I don't think we're going to go long today, but you never know. All right, then on Thursday, we're going to have a lecture on autonomic nervous system and maybe start some sensory physiology that same day. So if you want to read ahead, that would be really good. Read up on that autonomic nervous system. But you already know a lot about the autonomic nervous system because you studied it in anatomy. And how many divisions does the autonomic nervous system have if we were going to break it down into major categories?
Two
major categories. And you got to know their names. Yeah, the sympathetic and parasympathetic, and you should know about what they're all about. And basically, what they're all about is antagonism. And so if the parasympathetic is excitatory, then the sympathetic is inhibitory, and these signals blend together to bring you precise control and balance in your body. All right, so then after that, we got exam two on chapters 4, 5, and 7 on next Tuesday. And some of you might have a disaster drill to do on Thursday coming up. We'll see. Oh, that's good. I'm glad I noticed that. Because if we can't get into class right at 11:30, maybe we can get into class at noon or maybe at 12:15. I still would like for you to come even late to class in case we want to catch up on anything for the exam that's coming up on Tuesday. All right. So even if we can't start right on time, we'll start in the middle of the class period so that we don't lose too much time. Unless somebody's serving drinks outside in the parking lot, which I intend to do. I'm going to bring my cooler and a lawn chair. So maybe everybody will. Okay, any questions on material that we've covered so far? No, we're good? Okay, so let's start the slideshow. Let's try this. But I've lost the cursor. I'm not sure where the cursor is. Ah, here it is. And I don't want to lose it again. Okay, so you're getting pretty sophisticated with the nervous system now because you understand what the two cells, the general cells in the nervous system do, neurons and neuroglia. We looked at both of those functions. And now we're pretty much just talking about what the job of the neuron is, which is the basic unit of the nervous system. And we talked about the language. What's the language of the nervous system? What's the language of a neuron? The language of a neuron. What's the language of DNA? What's the building block of DNA? That's a nucleotide. Yeah, what's the building block of RNA? It's a nucleotide. It's the same, so it's the same language, right? So that's how we call that transcription. What's the building block of an amino acid? Oh, no, I'm sorry. Of a protein, sorry. I'm thinking of the next question already. What's a building block of a protein? Amino acid. Okay. Well, the building block of communication within the nervous system is an action potential. Okay, action potentials, and what does an action potential sound like? Just like a blip. Okay, it's just a blip. It's just a very short burst of energy, all right, moving through a neuron. And what can you tell me about action potentials? Are there different kinds? Are there like blue ones or green ones? Or they're all the same, right? So one blip is just like another. So how is it that you can perceive different modalities, and how is it you can perceive different intensities of a particular modality? Like sound could be real soft, okay, or it could be really loud. Why is that? If all action potentials are the same, why is that? Because the intensity is coded in how fast the action potentials arrive at the brain at a certain period of time. We call that frequency coding. So the faster the action potentials or more action potentials per unit time, then the intensity increases. And then you can tell the difference between a sound and vision because those same action potentials will go to a different part of the brain. Right? So the language is action potential, and every action potential is the same. Certain senses will seem different than others, not because the action potentials are different, but because those action potentials go to different parts of the brain. So if we were to artificially stimulate the occipital lobe, what would happen to you? This is a blast from the past. What would you experience if we were to electrically stimulate your occipital lobe? That's part of your brain, right? You aware of that? Good. Okay, part of your brain. That your brain will interpret that as action potentials. And what will you experience? Vision, because that's where your primary visual cortex is. Your primary auditory cortex is in the temporal lobe. So if we just stimulate the temporal lobe, what will happen? You'll hear something, right? It probably won't make much sense, just like if we stimulate your occipital lobe, the vision that you get probably won't make sense, but you at least see something, right? But it's all going to be action potentials. You experience different things because it goes to different parts of the brain, depending on the wiring, all right? So the language of this beast right here, this neuron, is an action potential. And action potentials are the result of certain kinds of proteins in the membrane of an axon. And those proteins are absent in dendrites and cell bodies. What kind of proteins am I thinking about? Something that changed the membrane potential to cause that action potential. So it is a channel for an ion. So ions can move across the membrane, and the kinds of channels that make action potentials are voltage-gated channels. They open or close depending on the voltage across the membrane. That's why action potentials can exist on an axon, but they can't exist on a dendrite or cell body because there are no voltage-gated channels on that part of the neuron. But this is the receiving part of a neuron. It can receive signals in the form of a chemical messenger from a neighboring neuron to change the membrane potential by allowing a change in permeability of ions across the membrane. So if they're not voltage-gated channels, what kind of channels do we have on dendrites and cell body? Ligand-gated channels. That's right. And those ligand-gated channels don't produce action potentials. They produce what kind of electrical event? A graded potential. And graded potentials are vastly different than action potentials. Because, anybody have an idea how could we contrast a graded potential from an action potential? Okay, we're going to talk about that today, but graded potentials could be very large in amplitude or small in amplitude. And from the site of stimulation, as they move away from that site of excitation, what happens to a graded potential as it moves away? Yeah, it decreases in amplitude. It fades away. Like if you're just to ting a bell, it'd ring really loud for just a second and then it would die away. Same thing for a graded potential. Action potentials, don't forget, at the axon hillock, they're exactly the same as compared if they were all the way down here at the axon terminus. Same amplitude and same width, same everything about them. Right? So they are transmitted without decrement. Graded potentials are with decrement. And we learned last time that there are two kinds of graded potentials, as a matter of fact, depending on what they do to the cell membrane. Sometimes a graded potential hyperpolarizes and sometimes a graded potential depolarizes, right? And if it depolarizes, we call that excitatory. That's an EPSP. If it inhibits, or if it hyperpolarizes, that's an IPSP, or it inhibits the cell. Okay, and what about an action potential? Can there ever be a negative action potential or an inhibitory action potential? No, because they're always the same. They're always depolarizing. They're always excitatory. So those are some important things that you should remember about this neuron and what kind of membrane proteins it has. It has different kinds of channels, either ligand or voltage-gated channels, which produces different electrical activity in different regions of the cell. And in the axon hillock, this is the first place, as a signal is received from a dendrite as it flows over the cell body, a graded potential in particular, when it reaches the axon hillock right here, if that graded potential is at threshold, this is what can start an action potential moving down this axon. This is the first location where we find voltage-gated channels. That's in the axon hillock. All right, so the axon hillock has many voltage-gated channels. It's a site where action potentials are normally initiated. So that's the important thing about the axon hillock. So it integrates. It can receive signals from all these different dendrites and then make up its mind. The cell can make up its mind whether it wants to transmit any of that information as an action potential down to the axon terminus. So every neuron in your body is acting like a nice logic circuit, even all by itself. That's pretty amazing. Okay. All right. So I think that's all I wanted to say about this slide. We were talking about synaptic transmission. Remember, synapses, got two kinds of synapses, chemical synapses and electrical synapses. Electrical synapses are a result of gap junctions. Talk to me if you can't remember how those work. All right, but this right here is a chemical synapse. This is the usual kind that we find in the body, especially the nervous system, at all neuromuscular junctions as well. So you should understand this flow diagram. So for instance, if an action potential is initiated at an axon hillock, then it's going to flow down an axon all the way to the axon terminus. It's going to depolarize the axon terminus, and when it depolarizes, that opens up other voltage-gated channels specifically for calcium. And then calcium enters the cell. That's an important signaling molecule. And that calcium then causes release of neurotransmitter because it might phosphorylate something or bind to calmodulin and change the activity of some enzymes inside the cell or that terminal button and cause docking and fusion of a vesicle and exocytosis of neurotransmitter into this space right here that's not clearly labeled on this slide. But if you were going to label this space between these two boxes, what would you call this space right here? Yeah, the synaptic cleft. And neurotransmitter then moves from high concentration to low across the synaptic cleft, where it might bind to a receptor in the postsynaptic membrane. All right, so and that would then be called a ligand-gated channel. If that opens up a channel for sodium to diffuse inside, and you should be aware of why sodium wants to move inside. Could anybody tell me why does sodium want to move inside the cell if we open up a ligand-gated channel for sodium? How come it doesn't want to leave the cell? Because the electrochemical gradient is directed inside the cell. The concentration gradient is directed inside the cell, and the voltage of these particles is directed inside the cell. So we call that electrochemical gradient. Because sodium is a cation, you should see a symbol in your mind for cation, and the inside of the cell is negative. What can you tell me about opposite charges? They attract each other. Okay, so if sodium diffuses inside the cell through those open ligand-gated channels, that produces an excitation, an EPSP, that depolarization. All right, and that's a graded potential. It's localized. It starts to travel over the cell, and as it travels, it gets smaller and smaller in amplitude. Okay, and if the graded potential, by the time it reaches the axon hillock, is at threshold, then that will open up some voltage-gated channels, and that will initiate an action potential in a way that an action potential goes down the whole axon. And what do we call an action potential in motion? That is a nerve impulse. Yeah, nerve impulse is just an action potential. That's a nice way of thinking of it. Most people in the world probably would agree with that. Okay, so we're going to spend some time talking about the synapse in particular and some of the signaling compounds that move across the synaptic cleft. Acetylcholine is one of them. It's always abbreviated capital A, capital C, lowercase h. Acetylcholine, you're probably familiar with this first term right here. What does this look like? Acetyl, yeah, that's an acetyl group. That's just how many carbons are in this group right here? You've run into that before. It's plentiful in cells, this acetyl group. And then choline is another biological molecule. And if cells put an acetyl group and a choline together, they get this nifty neurotransmitter. It's used in the brain and autonomic nervous system, but also at all neuromuscular junctions. Every single neuromuscular junction uses acetylcholine as a neurotransmitter that has to diffuse across that synaptic cleft from the presynaptic cell to the postsynaptic cell. And fortunately, there are two kinds of receptors for acetylcholine. All right, so acetylcholine is just one molecule. Acetylcholine is acetylcholine. But it might have different effects in the body, and that's because there are different kinds of receptors that a cell might put in the cell membrane. The two general categories are nicotinic and muscarinic receptors. These are subtypes of receptors, and guess what they bind? Guess what a nicotinic receptor binds? Acetylcholine. Guess what a muscarinic receptor binds? Acetylcholine. But these receptors can have different activities inside the cell, even though it's the same neurotransmitter, because these receptors are different. Their basic nature is different. So sometimes when acetylcholine binds to a receptor, it's excitatory, which means what? It causes what? Depolarization, like, for instance, opening up a sodium channel. Sometimes when acetylcholine binds to a receptor, it's inhibitory. How on earth could that happen? because it binds to a receptor, opens up a channel for potassium, for instance. So potassium wants to leave the cell, and as a positive charge leaves the cell, what happens to inside the cell in terms of the electrical properties? Becomes more negative. What do we call that? Hyperpolarization, which is what? Inhibitory on that cell. So all depends on what kind of channel is opened, and as a matter of fact, maybe even closed. Okay, so so a ligand-gated channel has to have a receptor site for the neurotransmitter, and also a channel that goes across the membrane. And this receptor is extracellular. It's got to be on the outside surface of the cell, because neurotransmitters typically don't enter a cell. They bind to a receptor right on the cell surface. And these channels then open when the neurotransmitter binds to this particular receptor. And here's a really nice diagram that shows a nicotinic-type acetylcholine channel. So here is the nice phospholipid bilayer. Acetylcholine cannot diffuse through this phospholipid bilayer because it's a polar compound, can't get inside the cell. But it's going to have an effect inside the cell because it's going to bind to an extracellular receptor here on the surface of the cell membrane. And you can see that acetylcholine on this representation is nice and spherical, so the receptor is going to match that form. So we always explain binding by the matching shape of the ligand and receptor. So if acetylcholine was square, what would happen? It couldn't bind, and then it couldn't activate this channel. It's got to match up exactly. So other molecules, other neurotransmitters, for instance, like epinephrine or serotonin or dopamine, can't bind to this receptor because doesn't have the right shape. So it can't activate this particular kind of receptor or channel. And this particular nicotinic channel has two receptor sites. Both have to be bound to acetylcholine before it changes conformation. So instead of you sitting next to your friend that pokes you with one finger in the side in order to get you moved, then you need a friend on one side, a friend on the other, and they both have to poke you in the side at the same time. Okay, so this is a little different. And when these two acetylcholines bind, then this changes state from a closed channel to an open channel, and sodium is going to rush inside the cell. Some potassium is going to leave, but by far the most important effect is sodium entering. As sodium is entering, what does that cause on the cell? Depolarization, and that is excitatory because that changes the membrane potential toward threshold. It moves it to threshold. And if it does reach threshold by the time there are voltage-gated channels around someplace, then that will make a nice action potential. All right, so this is a closed channel, okay, because it's not binding two ligands. Only one ligand is bound right here, so this is that sodium channel. But don't forget, you know, when you were thinking of an action potential, we had to also draw in an inactivation gate, which then kind of shows you that an action potential can't go on forever. Okay. All right, so we said that for acetylcholine, there are not only nicotinic channels like this, but there are also muscarinic channels. Okay, so we're going to take a look at those. The reason why we call this a nicotinic channel is because there is a compound called nicotine that is very similar in shape to acetylcholine that can bind in this receptor site. So nicotine can activate these kinds of channels in your body. So you might be interested, well, how come smoking a cigarette just isn't fatal when that happens? Maybe we can understand that process in a little bit. Okay, so that's a nicotinic channel. The other kind was muscarinic, because there is a compound from a mushroom called muscarin that has the right shape to bind to these other kinds of receptors that we call muscarinic receptors. They're located in different cells, different parts of the body. All right, so, and these are G-protein coupled channels. So this is kind of a blast from the past. The first test, we had a G-protein coupled signal transduction scheme where the first messenger was stuck outside the cell, binds to a receptor, which then activates these G proteins that are inside the membrane, and they float around inside the membrane activated, and when they bump into other things in the membrane, they can change the physiology of the membrane, maybe by opening channels or causing an enzyme to become activated. All right, I've got some nice schemes for you to look at in following slides. All right, so the neurotransmitter receptor is not part of the ion channel. They're separate in this case for a muscarinic receptor. They're two different proteins, but remember the fluid nature of a protein, of a membrane. These proteins can float around, and other substances can float around in lipid world of a plasma membrane. And a G protein is, or the channel is a one subunit membrane polypeptide. That's the channel. And it activates ion channels indirectly through G protein. So here's a pretty good illustration. I see a nice phospholipid bilayer. And then acetylcholine is trapped outside the cell, can't get through the cell membrane because it is polar. It's way too polar to enter the cell. So it's going to find a little nook right here. This is the receptor site. It matches up by shape perfectly. This is the receptor, and the receptor spans the whole membrane. But acetylcholine never enters the cell. It's stuck outside. It's a messenger signal, but it's stuck outside the cell. What kind of messenger is it? It's called the first messenger, right? Because it can't ever get inside the cell. So it binds to the G protein. The G protein also has associated with it. No, this is the receptor. Here is the receptor with the receptor site. This receptor then is coupled to G proteins. And remember, a G protein has three subunits. When the receptor binds, these can dissociate from the receptor and even partially from each other, like the alpha can separate from the beta and gamma subunits. All right, so now they're free from the receptor and they can float around in lipid world right here, and they can bump into another protein. For instance, this is a channel. And what kind of channel does this look like? It's a potassium channel because it has the right shape to allow the size of potassium to move. And when the beta and gamma subunit bump into this potassium channel that's normally closed, it causes, that's like your friend poking you in the side once again, changes conformation, opens up the channel. So what's going to happen to potassium? Where's potassium at a high concentration? Inside the cell, very low outside the cell, so the chemical gradient is going to force potassium outside the cell. And when a cation leaves the cell, what happens to the membrane potential? When a cation or a positive charge leaves the cell, what happens to the voltage inside the cell? It becomes more negative. And what do we call that? That's hyperpolarization. Okay, so these muscarinic channels can cause hyperpolarization, maybe by opening some potassium channels, but there could also be potassium channels that are normally open. If these are normally open, then the cell is normally inhibited, it's normally hyperpolarized. But when the beta and gamma subunit bind to a potassium channel that's normally open, it closes, right? And when it closes, what happens? Potassium can't leave the cell, so the cell can't hyperpolarize. What happens then? It depolarizes. Okay, so depends on what kind of channel it is. Acetylcholine through these muscarinic channels can cause hyperpolarization or inhibition or depolarization or excitation. All depends on the kind of channel and whether it's opening or closing after ligand binds to the receptor. All right, so you should appreciate the difference between a muscarinic acetylcholine receptor and a nicotinic acetylcholine receptor. And that is muscarinic work through G protein coupled receptors, and nicotinic is just a straight, non-fancy, ligand gated channel right here. And the nicotinic require two acetylcholines, this G protein coupled, just one. Okay, so this is a pretty good scheme for you to know. Okay, well, so you can consider this a switch where we open and close this channel depending on the demands of the cell and how it wants to communicate with the rest of the cells around it. So think of this as a switch. Think of it as a switch in the room right here, like that switch right there. What would you think of that switch if you could only operate it one time? Say if the lights were off, you came in and you turned it on, and then the lights were stuck on forever. Would that be a really handy switch? No, it'd be a pretty lousy switch. Or if the lights are on and you turn it off, then you'd never be able to get the lights back on. If you could only operate that switch one time, it'd be a lousy switch, right? So your body works the same way. You have to reset these switches periodically so you can turn things on or off, just like that wall switch over here. So there is a compound that breaks down acetylcholine so that it can't bind to receptor and then influence this receptor for the rest of your life, because then your lights would be turned on forever or turned off forever. Okay, so this resets that system. And the enzyme that does that is acetylcholinesterase. How do you know this is an enzyme? Because there's an ASE on the end of that word. And the substrate is part of the name of the enzyme, so this is a nice modern nomenclature for this enzyme. It activates acetylcholine, terminating its action, and it's located in the postsynaptic membrane, at least most of it is in the postsynaptic membrane. Here's the presynaptic membrane, and that terminates the action of acetylcholine so that if we want to send another signal across this synapse, then we need another action potential to release more acetylcholine. So it terminates the action of acetylcholine. So here is acetylcholinesterase, and goodness gracious, what does it break acetylcholine down into? Acetate and choline. Okay, and then these can be taken back up by the presynaptic cell, and if the cell wants, it can recombine them into acetylcholine and put them in a synaptic vesicle to be transmitted again. So this terminates the action of acetylcholine, and that is acetylcholinesterase. Various neurons do this in different ways with different kinds of enzymes and different kinds of schemes. Another kind of scheme is where you have an astrocyte that can actually take up. When it sees acetylcholine, it will take it up into the glial cell, also decreasing the activity of acetylcholine at this synapse. So neuroglia cells sometimes can help regulate synaptic transmission. Let's look at some other kinds of neurotransmitters. Well, but I still have to, but first, we got to finish up acetylcholine, okay? Acetylcholine in the peripheral nervous system. Any kind of neuron that secretes acetylcholine as its neurotransmitter is what we call a cholinergic neuron. All right, so all these neurons that we were looking at so far that release acetylcholine, these are what we call cholinergic neurons. A neuron that secretes another kind of neurotransmitter is not going to be cholinergic. There are particularly large synapses between somatic motor neurons and a skeletal muscle. And they're termed end plates. So they're big in terms of surface area. They release a lot of neurotransmitter. So if they release a lot of neurotransmitter, these are all nicotinic type receptors. I don't know if it says it on this slide over here, but what's a nicotinic receptor? Let's go back real quick. Here's a nicotinic receptor at a neuromuscular junction. When acetylcholine binds, what happens? What's the event? Is it excitatory or inhibitory? It's excitatory because it causes depolarization. And there are so many of these channels in a neuromuscular junction that it always reaches threshold. So a skeletal muscle can never make up its mind whether or not it's going to contract. It gets a signal from a neuron. What does that muscle do? It contracts. I tell it to relax, it relaxes. I tell it to contract, it contracts. Skeletal muscle can never make up its own mind. That's why we say it's under voluntary control. Your mind controls it because the nicotinic receptors are always excitatory, and there are so many of them at a neuromuscular junction that it causes a threshold graded potential. All right, it produces these really large EPSPs called end plate potentials, and also within the neuromuscular junction or in the periphery of the neuromuscular junction. Now, don't forget, we're talking about a muscle cell. Right, we're not talking about another neuron, so dendrites and cell body and axon doesn't make sense for a muscle cell, but the whole muscle cell is covered with voltage-gated channels, even in the motor end plate. So when there's this massive depolarization, this massive EPSP, what does it always produce in a muscle cell? Because the graded potential doesn't even have to go anywhere. Because right there are voltage-gated channels. That means that as soon as neurotransmitter is released at the neuromuscular junction, that causes an action potential on a muscle cell. And what can you tell me about an action potential? It causes an impulse. Electrical impulse travels over the whole muscle cell. It excites the whole muscle cell at one time because a muscle cell has voltage-gated channels everywhere on the cell membrane. Now, if it was a neuron, where would you find voltage-gated channels? Only on the axon, not on the dendrite or cell body. So there's a little bit of a difference. Actually, it's a pretty huge difference. Okay, so muscle cells, at least skeletal muscle cells, have voltage-gated channels everywhere. There is a compound that can block the binding of acetylcholine to its receptor, and if it blocks the binding to the receptor, then it can't change the state of conformation of that nicotinic channel, receptor channel, and so it prevents depolarization. Curare can prevent depolarization in the motor end plate. And if you prevent depolarization, what's that another way of thinking? That's like saying what? You're preventing what? Excitation, yeah, or an action potential. And if you can't if you can't excite a muscle, it's not going to contract. Okay? So that's a particularly nifty kind of little nuclear weapon that some folks have used to learn to use. They could coat really tiny darts with curare, inject them into big game, and then the big game, because they use their skeletal muscles to run away just like we would, guess what? They couldn't run away. So it's a really easy way of hunting. But what's another skeletal muscle? Diaphragm. When it's poisoned, animal can't breathe. We can't run very far either if we're not breathing, right? So it's a particularly interesting way of hunting with very small kinds of arms. Okay, monoamine neurotransmitters. You should know these. These are serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine. We'll try to understand some of these different things, but at least at a chemical basis, serotonin is derived from tryptophan. We didn't spend a whole lot of time with different kinds of amino acids, but tryptophan is an amino acid, and so is tyrosine. These two amino acids belong to an interesting group of amino acids that humans cannot make anymore. We cannot make tryptophan. We can't make tyrosine. So what does that mean? If our body wants to make serotonin or norepinephrine and dopamine, where do we get tryptophan and tyrosine from? From our diet. That has to be in our diet, and the easiest way to incorporate tryptophan and tyrosine in our diet is by eating a meat product, right? Not by just eating vegetables. You can, if you're smart about it, okay? Maybe if you eat rice and beans together in the right combination, you can get both tryptophan and tyrosine so that you can make a protein, and that you learn from your culture. You don't really maybe know why you're doing that, but culturally you just know you should mix these foods together to maintain health. Okay, so that's sort of the reason. So these neurotransmitters right here are based on or are modified forms of what we call essential amino acids, meaning your body can't make them, they have to be in your diet. Otherwise, you run out of these neurotransmitters. And if you don't have these neurotransmitters, what's the result? They're important things for synaptic transmission. So neurons can't communicate with each other if you don't have these amino acids in your diet. Okay, so that's interesting that diet can affect how our nervous system works, because modifying our diet will modify what kinds of neurotransmitters can be made. All right, all of these, serotonin, norepinephrine, and dopamine, are what we call catecholamines. These are called catecholamines. So what kind of sticks out right here? Amines. Yeah, there's a nitrogen group on these things. All right, that's maybe a nice way to think about it. Okay, so here is the presynaptic neuron, here's a postsynaptic neuron, here's the synaptic cleft, and we see tyrosine modified into something, we're just going to abbreviate it, we call that DOPA, that gets turned into dopamine, and then dopamine is modified into norepinephrine. Norepinephrine then is the neurotransmitter that's going to be released. All right, so norepinephrine is dependent on the amount of tyrosine that you have in your body that's stored in these synaptic vesicles. All right, so remember, an action potential comes down the presynaptic cell, and it causes depolarization. That activates voltage-gated calcium channels, just like what we've looked at before. That calcium enters the cell, and through a number of different pathways that can cause the movement of this synaptic vesicle with neurotransmitter to the presynaptic membrane, where it fuses, it docks, and then it exocytoses neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft, which then moves by diffusion from high concentration to low to the postsynaptic membrane. And that norepinephrine then can change the physiology of the postsynaptic membrane, because it has what? It has something to receive that signal. And it's a receptor that matches up just by the shape of that molecule. Right? And norepinephrine, okay, can have different effects on the cell depending on what kind of receptor it is. But if you look at this receptor right here, how many binding sites does it look like it has? Right, here's one. Here's one. How many receptor sites? I see one here. And then I see here's a different receptor. How many receptor sites on this one? One. I see one here, and I see one here, and I see one here. Could that be a nicotinic type receptor? No, because nicotinic had binding sites for two acetylcholines. What does this remind you of? A G-protein coupled receptor, right? So norepinephrine receptors are G-protein coupled receptors, right? Norepinephrine does not enter the cell. And that norepinephrine, just like acetylcholine, has to be reduced in the synaptic cleft so that you can resend another signal, so that this postsynaptic cell isn't depolarized for its entire lifetime, right? That would be terrible. So norepinephrine has to be done away with, just like acetylcholine. And there are a couple of different ways where that is accomplished. For catecholamines, like serotonin, norepinephrine, the way that it's removed from the synaptic cleft is that there are pumps. There are reuptake proteins that actually grab hold of a norepinephrine and put it back into the presynaptic cell. We call that reuptake. And when serotonin or norepinephrine go back to the presynaptic cell, it's removed from the synaptic cleft so that it could be re-released once again to re-excite these receptors in the postsynaptic cell. All right, so reuptake is an important mechanism. So for instance, if somebody is running low on neurotransmitter, maybe because, why? Why would somebody be running low on neurotransmitter? They're not eating tyrosine in their diet. Okay, and you know what? We can maybe help this person by having them take a drug that blocks the reuptake mechanism. So if it blocks that reuptake mechanism, then just a little bit of neurotransmitter here will have the same effect as under normal circumstances where a lot is released. I know that sounds complicated. Why don't you just do what? Why don't you just eat tyrosine? I don't know. That's compliance. That's the most difficult issue I'm sure all of you have already experienced with family or yourself and in medicine, is how do you get patients to take care of themselves? Okay, what's the easiest way? Diet and exercise. Now don't throw anything at me, right? Those are the two most important things. And then if you don't want to do that, then you got to take these other pharmaceutical agents. Okay, well, what's the downside about not exercising and not having a good diet and having to take drugs? There's always side effects to drugs that you don't want, right? So anyway, okay, let's get back to this neuron right here. So reuptake is a way of terminating the action of norepinephrine. And there's another way, and that is by an enzyme called COMT. You don't have to know what it's called, but C stands for catecholamine or catechol-O-methyltransferase, and it changes the shape of norepinephrine. So if you change the shape of norepinephrine, what do you change? Yeah, you change its function, so it can't bind to this receptor anymore, and so it loses its effect. So there are a couple different ways. It can be degraded by COMT, or it can be taken back up by the presynaptic cell. This is not what happens with acetylcholine. How is acetylcholine's action terminated within a synapse? Acetylcholinesterase, right, would be the key term, both at the neuromuscular junction and in neurons. All right, so we said, that looked like a G protein on that postsynaptic membrane. And indeed, here it is right here. So here is the receptor. And then here is the G protein. So this is a G protein coupled receptor. When norepinephrine binds to this one receptor site right here, it causes dissociation of alpha and the beta gamma subunits. And these things can float around where? Can float around in lipid world, right? Because they're lipophilic compounds. And they can bump into other proteins that are in the membrane, including this thing right here, which we call adenylate cyclase. What can you tell me about adenylate cyclase? ASE. It's an enzyme because there's an ASE on the end of it, and it sort of tells you what the substrate is. It's ATP. So it can take an ATP that's intracellular, not extracellular anymore, right? Remember, the first messenger is outside the cell, norepinephrine, activates this G protein, causes activation of adenylate cyclase, which then can take an ATP and have it form an AMP, so it chops off two phosphate groups, but a special kind of monophosphate right here. It's in a cyclic form. All right, so is there a difference in physiology of a molecule that's linear compared to a molecule that's cyclic? And why? Because when you change the shape of something, you change its whole identity. You just change the whole function of it, right? So cyclic AMP is radically different than just regular AMP, and it can bind, and it can bind to an enzyme, a protein kinase, one that is inactive. When it binds cyclic AMP, it becomes active. And what the heck does a kinase do? Yeah, or at least an active kinase. An active kinase will run around phosphorylating things, right? So it will grab an ATP and phosphorylate other molecules. And if we were to jam a big phosphate molecule on you, what would you do? you'd change conformation, right? It'd be like your friend poking you in the side. So this protein kinase runs around, phosphorylates other kinds of molecules. Proteins then will change their conformation, and if it's a channel, okay, it can cause an opening of a channel when it becomes phosphorylated. All right, and if it's an ion channel, then that's going to change the membrane potential across the cell membrane. All right, and that's due to binding of cyclic AMP to this protein kinase. And you should know that a protein kinase is for phosphorylation. What's the antagonistic enzyme? Phosphatase will then balance this out, right? We'll take a phosphate off, right? And then we'll have the opposite effect on this channel right here. Okay, so this protein kinase can activate a number of different kinds of proteins inside the cell. If it's a channel, it could cause this channel to open up, or it could cause it to close, depending on the kind of channel that could excite or inhibit the cell. All depends, just like what we looked at with the muscarinic type, which was a G protein coupled type receptor. All right, so this is sort of interesting because this is a second messenger system. I want to say just a couple things about a second messenger system. Oh, wow, I'm having too much fun in lecture today. Glad we have another lecture. Second messenger system means what? How many messengers are there? There's two. Where are they located? Where's the first one located? Always outside the cell. Where's the second one located? Always inside the cell. So norepinephrine is the first messenger. What's the second messenger? Aha, look at this. Cyclic AMP is what I want you to focus on. Cyclic AMP is the second messenger because it's going to change the physiology inside the cell by activating this protein kinase right here. All right, so cyclic AMP is second messenger. All right, so let's go back even a step further. Here is that G protein. It bumps into adenylate cyclase, and you should know what adenylate cyclase does. It produces the second messenger inside the cell, so it's an enzyme. All right, and what can you tell me about an enzyme, this adenylate cyclase, when it converts one ATP into one cyclic AMP? What happens to adenylate cyclase? Just like any other enzyme. This is probably really important for the test coming up. It lowers the activation energy, yeah. It converts what into what? It converts reactants into products, all right? That's what an enzyme does. It speeds up that reaction. I mean, ATP wants to be converted into cyclic AMP, but it can't unless there's an enzyme to decrease the activation energy, all right? But what about that enzyme before and after that step of catalysis? What about adenylate cyclase after the reaction compared to adenylate cyclase before the reaction? It's still the same. It's still active, right? So if it can zip ATP into cyclic AMP once, it can do it how many times? Many times, maybe thousands of times. But how many signaling molecules, how many first messengers did that require? It required one first messenger producing what? Thousands of second messengers inside the cell. So that's a level of amplification. So that's pretty nifty. You can have just one simple signaling compound outside the cell, you can end up with thousands inside the cell. But that's not all. Cyclic AMP activates what? Another enzyme. So you have a protein kinase that runs around inside the cell, phosphorylating proteins inside the cell. But after it phosphorylates a protein inside the cell, does it become inactive? No, an enzyme does not get used up during the reaction, right? So this protein kinase can phosphorylate maybe thousands of molecules. So here we have another level of amplification. One signaling compound can produce maybe 1,000 cyclic AMPs, and these 1,000 cyclic AMPs can, each one can activate maybe 1,000 phosphorylated proteins. So now you got 10,000 phosphorylated proteins inside the cell, all due to what? One signaling molecule outside the cell. So this is what we call a cascade mechanism. Okay, when you have multiple steps of amplification, and so that can do what? That can take a really tiny signal and make it a huge, hugely important signal inside the cell, changing the activity of the physiology inside the cell. So cascade mechanisms are pretty important. Sometimes these take a little bit longer to operate, right, because you got to go through all these different steps in order to open up an ion channel compared to just a like we were looking at right here, to this nicotinic channel, because as soon as the receptor binds the ligand, this channel opens up. There's a little bit of a latency period with these G protein coupled receptors, but these levels of amplification help speed up that process. All right, so when you have a multiple levels of amplification, we call that a cascade mechanism that helps speed up this kind of physiologic process. Okay, serotonin is one of these catecholamines. It's involved in regulation of mood, behavior, appetite, and even cerebral blood flow. And gee whiz, what does your brain need in order to function? Good blood flow, right? So if serotonin is regulating blood flow, that can help regulate different activities in different parts of the brain. That's a pretty important effect of serotonin. But it's also works as a neurotransmitter. LSD, I don't even think I can remember what that stands for. Okay, but it's what, a hallucinogen? Recreationally used? Don't know, maybe you guys never heard of it anymore. I'm not sure. Do you know what LSD is anymore? It's a hallucinogen? Yeah, okay. It's structurally similar, so it can bind to what kind of receptors? Because it has a similar shape to serotonin, it's going to bind to serotonin receptors that are in the brain and give you all these inappropriate kinds of sensations. Okay, just manufactured sensations. There are specific reuptake inhibitors for serotonin. We call these SSRIs, and these are used as antidepressants. So there are certain parts of human brains when they reduce their activity, maybe due to reduced blood flow or other kinds of things, the activity decreases. It can be treated by increasing the action of serotonin within the synapse by using reuptake inhibitors. Here's a list of some reuptake inhibitors. I think these are all still on the market. So they block reuptake of serotonin, okay, thus prolonging the action of serotonin. But somebody might be, for instance, depressed because why? What's necessary in order for you to make serotonin? Yeah, you need tyrosine. Maybe your diet isn't proper. Is that amazing? So depression is clinical depression. Right, that's a clinical disorder, and now you can see how diet can affect these clinical disorders. That's kind of interesting, I think. Okay, but nonetheless, what's the most difficult thing to do? Diet and exercise. Okay, dopamine, another kind of catecholamine. There are two major dopaminergic systems in the brain. Oh, this is looking good. Looks like we might be able to finish. Okay, one is the nigrostriatal dopaminergic system. It's in the substantia nigra. It's involved in motor control. What the heck is motor control? Control of skeletal muscles in particular, not cardiac, not smooth muscles. All right, and when somebody has pathology in this particular area, substantia nigra, then they have trouble not controlling their heart, not controlling smooth muscles in their body like digestive tract or reproductive tract, but skeletal muscles. They have difficulty moving their skeleton around. And that condition is called Parkinson's disease. Right? It involves this system right here. And people are still trying to figure out ways to reactivate this system by maybe giving them reuptake inhibitors or other kinds of pharmacologic agents. That would be really wonderful to be able to treat Parkinson's disease more effectively. It's a really active area of research. So if it's due to a neurotransmitter problem, that could be treated. But if it's due to trauma within the brain, then you might not be able to treat it because the structure of the neurons have already been damaged. So even if they have proper neurotransmitters, if the shape of a neuron is damaged by trauma, guess what? Its function is going to change as well. Okay, so Parkinson's disease, just a strange onset of Parkinson's disease could be caused by head trauma. You get into a motorcycle accident, car accident, or even maybe professional athletes if they get their head traumatized a lot. And for instance, a really good example of this was one of the best boxers in the world, Muhammad Ali, is suffering from Parkinson's disease because he just experienced too much trauma to his brain. And so he loses motor control of his skeletal muscle. And so he's very rigid. He has trouble relaxing muscles. So when he moves, it's very difficult to move because antagonistic muscles are fighting each other. And when he speaks, the same thing for muscles for articulation. He can't speak smoothly. He can't walk smoothly. And this is kind of important for you guys, I think, because you're going to end up seeing some patients with Parkinson's disease. But your initial impression might be, what, with a person with slurred speech and disturbed motor activity? that maybe they're intoxicated or maybe on drugs. You might think of them as a drug seeker, and you'll probably want to notice that in people right away, because you never know what a drug seeker is going to do to you or some other people that you're working with, right? So, but it's important to understand that people with Parkinson's disease are not drug seekers. They have this underlying physiologic condition, which you should help treat, right, and make their life better, and not just treat them with suspicion and all that kind of stuff, right? So what would be really bad is for you to treat somebody with Parkinson's disease as a drug seeker that is intoxicated under inappropriate conditions, right? Because you'll hurt their feelings and probably their whole family, and you'll hurt your feelings too. Not that I've ever done that, but I've seen that happen. Okay, so that is the niagrostriatal dopamine system. There's also a mesolimbic dopaminergic system. Oh, no, I do want to say one last thing about this. All right, so these receptors, these dopaminergic receptors, are important for causing relaxation of skeletal muscles so that you can move smoothly. There was a case in Britain maybe about 25 or 30 years ago. That's just a guess on my part because time goes by really, really fast. And these people were taking some synthetic hallucinogens, and those drugs actually turned out to have a very similar shape to dopamine. So those recreational drugs would bind to what kind of receptors? Dopamine receptors in the nigrostriatal system right here. And it just so happened that that particular modification of that drug would never release from the receptor site. So guess what would happen? That's like flicking a switch on all the time. And those addicts became frozen as a result of that. So if you want to Google frozen addicts, you can find that. So if you're going to experiment with drugs, don't cook them up yourself, right? That's why pharmaceutical quality drugs are so expensive, right? But don't buy any cheap drugs from anybody, because you never know what the effect is going to be. So those addicts that were poisoned that way have normal mental function. They just can't move their body. They can experience everything. They just can't control their skeletal muscles. They're just frozen in bed for the rest of their life. I don't think there's any alive still anymore. Okay. The mesolimbic dopaminergic system is involved with behavior, okay, emotional reward, and amphetamines activate this system. Right? Overactivity of this system contributes to schizophrenia. So that's one of the biological understandings of how schizophrenia develops. It's another mental disorder. Okay, we talked about depression. Here's another one. So we're beginning to understand the biological basis for these different kinds of problems. And so schizophrenia can be treated by anti-dopamine drugs. All right, norepinephrine. It's used in the peripheral nervous system and central nervous system. Serotonin and dopamine, mostly in the central nervous system where it's used. Serotonin is used in other parts of the body, but not necessarily nervous system. But norepinephrine is found pretty much everywhere. In the peripheral nervous system, that means what, outside the brain and spinal cord, it's for the neurotransmitter of the sympathetic nervous system. And what can you tell me about sympathetic nervous system? Who's got an idea about sympathetic? Fight or flight, yeah, that characterizes the sympathetic nervous system. Right, the fight or flight mechanism, but in terms of anatomy, not so much function, but in terms of anatomy, how does sympathetic relate to your body? It's a part of something. It's a part of the autonomic nervous system. Okay, so just that's all I was trying to get at. It's part of the autonomic nervous system. It's one division, the fight or flight division. Right, and remember, most things in your body are controlled autonomically by the autonomic nervous system. So, and norepinephrine controls half of that nervous system. Right, so that's pretty important. Okay, in the CNS, it affects general level of arousal, and amphetamines stimulate these pathways as well. All right, so that can make people stay up for days on end. There are different kinds of neurotransmitters that are amino acids. So these are these are all water-soluble amino acids. Glutamic acid is an amino acid. Aspartic acid is an amino acid. Glycine is one. All right, so glutamic acid, aspartic acid are major excitatory neurotransmitters. Gee whiz, how do you think they work? When glutamic acid binds to a receptor, what happens? Depolarization. Same thing for aspartic acid, depolarization. Okay. Glycine, on the other hand, is an inhibitory neurotransmitter. It's going to work by Hyperpolarization. It's going to make the membrane potential drift farther away from threshold. It doesn't work through a sodium channel or a potassium channel. It works through chloride channels. Now, can you remember, where is chloride at a high concentration? Outside the cell. Okay, and when and it's negative inside the cell, but still, it's so high a concentration outside the cell, when a chloride channel opens up, chloride enters the cell, that hyperpolarizes the cell. Okay, and therefore, it's an inhibitory neurotransmitter. Now, inhibitory or excitatory does not necessarily mean good or bad. What means good in terms of excitation and inhibition? If they're mixed together properly, right? You got to have both excitation and inhibition in order to be normal. If you have one or the other, then that's an abnormal disease state, right? So that principle of antagonism. So strychnine is a particularly powerful kind of compound because when it gets into the central nervous system, right, it blocks glycine receptors, so it knocks out inhibition within the central nervous system, and that results are then found in skeletal muscle. So if skeletal muscles are not inhibited and all skeletal muscles are excited, what happens to them? They contract. So somebody that has strychnine poisoning, their skeletal muscles will all contract, especially the strong trunk muscles. And when that happens, then a person can't breathe. And they die in this kind of agony of just contracture all over. So that's a particularly nasty kind of poison by blocking these chloride channels. So remember, it's mixing of signals to bring balance and control. And that's through, what, antagonistic pathways, excitation and inhibition. GABA is another important amino acid neurotransmitter, gamma-aminobutyric acid. It's most common in the brain, and it's inhibitory because it opens chloride channels as well. All right, so that's kind of interesting. Now you see that the most common signal in the brain is what? Inhibition, to maintain balance, electrical balance in the brain. So these kinds of pathways degenerate in a disease called Huntington's disease. Okay, you can see some more in chapter 3. All right, so let's get back down to a molecular level. We just got done talking about molecules, but at a cellular level. Okay, so I see a nice neuron right here, and looks like peripheral nervous system because I see some Schwann cells. Remember, so this is the sending part of the neuron. Here's the receiving part. The receiving part has what kind of membrane proteins for receiving signals? Ligand-gated channels. And axons have what kind of membrane proteins? Voltage-gated channels to transmit action potentials. Did anybody understand what I just said? Raise your hand if you had the slightest idea. That's amazing, because it's weird stuff. You've never heard of stuff like that before, so that's nice, right? If you can picture proteins in here, different kinds of proteins doing radically different kinds of electrical manipulations of a cell membrane, that's really nice. Okay, so EPSPs are due to ligand-gated channels in dendrites and cell bodies. When a ligand binds to its receptor, like right here, okay, it causes this signal. Here's resting membrane potential. It changes the resting membrane potential. It moves closer to zero. That's what we call depolarization. Anything that causes depolarization is an EPSP. And I can see that if we vary the amount of neurotransmitter that's released, then this depolarization, right, grows when we release more neurotransmitter. So what kind of depolarization is this? Is this a graded potential or an action potential? It's got to be a graded potential, right? So graded potentials are produced by ligand-gated channels. They have no threshold. So if we start one over here, and then as it moves over the dendrite and cell body, what happens to it as it's traveling away? It dies down. But if it is at threshold, by the time it reaches the axon hillock right here, then it's going to cause an action potential on the axon. And what is the action potential going to be like when it reaches the axon terminus? Exactly the same at the axon hillock right here. So an action potential travels without decrement. All right, so EPSPs cause depolarization. They have no threshold. They can also summate together. And they also don't have a refractory period, so they take a little while to die out. Okay, so if we put this one together with this one, then we're going to get something that's even taller. Right, so that's going to be an important concept, and that is of summation. Okay, and we have a couple different kinds of summation. Spatial summation. Let's look at these neurons right here. We have a little neuronal circuit. Let's look at the output. Here's the postsynaptic cell. We only have one. And remember, every neuron can make a decision on what to do with information. Every one of these is a little logic circuit, and it's receiving information from how many cells? Two cells, two neurons right here. Okay, and maybe they'll be sending information at the same time, or maybe one, or maybe the other, or maybe neither of them will be sending signals to the postsynaptic neuron, but in this particular case, there are two. And we're measuring, what are we measuring right here? We're measuring the voltage on the postsynaptic cell. Okay, so here's the threshold for the postsynaptic cell, and here is RMP. And if the first neuron releases neurotransmitter, a certain dollop of neurotransmitter, it's going to cause a certain EPSP right here. But what can you tell me about this EPSP from neuron number one? It's sub-threshold. So is it going to cause an action potential to be transmitted to this axon terminus where I have the cursor on that postsynaptic neuron? So then this neuron is going to ignore that information and not pass it along because it doesn't consider it significant, right? Okay, but what happens if neuron number one and number two, these are the presynaptic neurons, both together release neurotransmitter, okay, and they both produce graded potentials, that when those two graded potentials reach the axon hillock, it reaches threshold, and now an action potential, right, because this information from two neurons has been integrated together, now the postsynaptic neuron makes a decision to send an action potential or forward that information down the line to another neuron. Okay, so this is spatial summation. It takes place when EPSPs from different synapses occur in a synaptic cell at the same time, right? Because graded potentials can summate. What about action potentials? Cannot summate because they have a refractory period. Graded potentials have no refractory period, right? So they can even flow backwards and forwards. But action potentials only in the forward direction or antigrade direction because of that refractory period. There's also something called temporal summation, and that is if a graded potential like maybe right here is produced by stimulation at this point in time, and then at a later point in time, a second stimulation comes from even the first neuron right here, before the first graded potential dies away, even graded potentials from one neuron, if they're close enough in time, can summate at the axon hillock to produce an action potential. And this is what we call temporal summation. So spatial summation requires at least two neurons to interact. Temporal summation could just be one neuron releasing neurotransmitter at different times, but sufficiently close together to cause an action potential. That's temporal summation. Okay, so that is, we're just looking at excitation, inhibition. Well, wow, we're doing pretty good. Inhibition, okay, if we're going to have excitation, it's got to be through an EPSP, but if it's going to inhibit the cell, it's going to be worked through an IPSP, maybe opening a potassium channel or a chloride channel, for instance. Right? So there's two different kinds of inhibition. There's postsynaptic inhibition and presynaptic inhibition. And on this slide, we see postsynaptic inhibition. And again, here is the postsynaptic neuron. So we're going to talk about inhibition within the postsynaptic neuron, right? That's why we call it postsynaptic inhibition. And we see that the postsynaptic neuron is receiving signals from two neurons, number one and number two. And it just so happens that neuron number one is going to release a hyperpolarizing neurotransmitter. And if it releases a hyperpolarizing neurotransmitter, what happens to resting membrane potential of the postsynaptic cell? Yeah, it moves farther away from threshold. We call that inhibition. So this is what we call an IPSP. Maybe by opening up a potassium channel or a chloride channel, for instance, that is inhibiting the cell. And then at another time, let's just say neuron number two over here releases an excitatory neurotransmitter, right? And that's going to cause depolarization. It's going to move it toward threshold. But in this particular case, did this EPSP right here cause an action potential? Because it was preceded by this IPSP. All right, if we just had this EPSP by itself right at resting membrane potential, that would have been a threshold potential and would have caused an action potential. But since it was preceded by information from neuron number one, then that inhibited the postsynaptic neuron. All right, so we call that postsynaptic inhibition. It's where the postsynaptic neuron just makes up its mind because threshold was not reached within the axon hillock. All right, so GABA and glycine produce IPSPs. IPSPs dampen the effect of EPSPs, and by making it harder to reach threshold, it doesn't mean that they can't be overcome. It just means what? You need a supra-threshold stimulus to overcome that inhibition. It's not total. Only in this case it is. Right? It still can be overcome with the proper depolarizing stimulus. All right, the next slide will show presynaptic inhibition. And that happens when one neuron synapses onto an axon or a bouton of another neuron. So here we have, actually I have maybe three presynaptic neurons, and they kind of look like red, and we only see the synaptic terminal right here. And then here's the postsynaptic neuron in gold. And what do we have between the red and gold? It's a nice synapse right there, right? Is that what you guys said? There's a synapse, because here is a terminal button of the presynaptic cell, and there's got to be receptors, ligand-gated channels, right, on the postsynaptic cell, and this is on a dendrite, right? So here is the presynaptic cell influencing the postsynaptic cell either on the cell body or on a dendrite. Can you guys remember what these things were called? It was like one of the last things in neuroanatomy. This is an axosomatic synapse because it's synapsing on the soma of the nerve. This is an axodendritic synapse because the synapse is on a dendrite. Okay. And then here's something that's interesting, and we're just beginning to realize and learn something about these other kind of synapses. Here is another synapse, all right, but where is it located? Is it on a dendrite? Is it on a cell body? Ooh, what's the last place? Axon. Here's a synapse on an axon, but it's on a presynaptic neuron, right? Because here's the postsynaptic neuron. And for instance, are they labeled? No, they're not labeled. So the top neuron, if it releases an inhibitory neurotransmitter on the axon of this other neuron right here, that could block the motion of an action potential across this segment of an axon. So this is what we call presynaptic inhibition because it's happening before these synapses that occur on the postsynaptic membrane of the cell that's being excited, this distal neuron right here. All right, so this is for presynaptic inhibition. And if inhibitory neurotransmitter is released on a dendrite or a cell body, this is what we call postsynaptic inhibition because that's going to produce an IPSP. And the reason why this causes inhibition because that inhibitory neurotransmitter will decrease the amplitude of an action potential so it can't transit this segment of the axon and will inhibit the signal being transmitted. Okay, so that's it for the test. How did that happen? Makes you wonder. We covered it all. All right, now what kind of questions do you have? Sign-in sheet is going around. So next time, you need a Scantron, eraser, pencil, and a photo ID. And that's on Tuesday. That's not next time. That's right. Next time is Thursday. Okay. All right, and I think you have some festivities planned in SI this week. Yeah. Okay, no questions. All right, you're free to go as soon as you sign the sign-in sheet.